Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Thank you for listening to episode 10. In our last episode, we dealt with May as being Mental Health Month and covered such statistics as 44 million Americans have to deal with mental illness, and 60% of adults with mental illness have not received any mental health services in the last year. But of course, numbers can't tell the whole story. I love epidemiology as much as anyone. Epidemiology is the science of the distribution and determinants of disease and health. And you'll hear a lot of epidemiology on this show, but I also love stories. And one way to tell stories is through poetry. Here on Just for the Health of It, we occasionally feature local poets expounding on public health-related themes. Today is one of those occasions. I was fortunate enough to hear Justin Sampson at a local poetry reading, debuting his poems on mental health. Justin Sampson is a creative from Indiana living in Northwest Ohio. He is a self-taught musician and experiments with art and writing. He received a bachelor's degree in psychology from Indiana University, and a master's degree in ministry and counseling from Bethel University. Justin's creative work often explores and attempts to destigmatize mental illness. In these poems, Justin set out to provide snapshots of various mental illnesses by researching common symptoms in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, commonly known as the DSM-5. You gotta love the fact that the DSM-5 is a inspiration for poetry. And we will be featuring Justin's poems in the coming weeks in his own voice. He has poems on bipolar disorder, major depression, narcissism, separation anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, agoraphobia, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Today's poem is on major depression.
Major depressive disorder, the fading walls of my house. There are 5 barricades in this room as I stare blankly at one, wondering on my life. This house was built in the early 1900s. If walls could talk, they would talk of pains of war, the loss of life, birth of another, the rise of a world and the fall of another. And they all lead to me, to now, staring blankly at the barrier, wondering on my life. What legacy would I leave behind? Or would I fade away, the wind-torn tombstone that no one visits anymore? What am I? Who am I? The haunting whispers. Is my legacy that I got bloated anytime I eat meat? Or maybe it's my 45,000 gamer points. Will I be remembered as a blurry-faced barista that served coffee? I used to think I was destined for greatness. Now I see I'm destined for obscurity. A blurry face in the background of someone else's life. I am haunted. I am haunted by my life. The faint moans of what could have. The distant screams of what should have. The blood on the wall shares my achievements or lack thereof. The skeletons in my closet forced to keep their secrets of the past. The dark figure standing in the corner, reminding me of my failures. The person in the mirror staring back in shame. I'm haunted by my life. Part 1. The Outside. A cool, calm, collected man stands in a group having a conversation. Others look on, wishing they could have the confidence, while still others think he's a jerk. He makes conversations look effortless. He's a dog at a dog show. Part 2. The Inside. The darkest black. No light exiting, no sound leaving. A boy sits back against the wall, knees to chest. He calls out, only to hear the echoing of darkness. Did you ever notice? Did you ever notice that if you turn a smiley face upside down, you get a frowny face? Did you ever notice that when you flip a coin, one side is always chasing the other side? Heads being chased by tails, a dog chasing his own tail, light being chased by darkness. They say opposites attract. That's the case for happiness. Where there is happiness, the yin to its yang stalks closely behind, a lion stalking his prey, waiting for the perfect time to strike when it's least expected. Did you ever notice the irony in the statement, happiness is a fleeting thought?
Thank you, Justin, for that poem. I hope some people could relate to that and we can accomplish some of our goal here, which is to decrease the stigma of a variety of mental illnesses. Now, back to the fact that over half of adults that have mental illnesses have not received any treatment in the last year. I encourage people to seek treatment if they have mental health issues. And I wanted to just cover real briefly mental health treatments. This from Mental Health America. Many people diagnosed with mental illness achieve strength and recovery through participating in individual or group treatment. There are many different treatment options available. There is no treatment that works for everyone. Individuals can choose the treatment or combination of treatments that works best. Psychotherapy. Psychotherapy is the therapeutic treatment of mental illness provided by a trained mental health professional. Psychotherapy explores thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and seeks to improve an individual's well-being. Psychotherapy paired with medication is the most effective way to promote recovery. Examples include cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, etc. Medication. Medication does not outright cure mental illness. However, it may help with the management of symptoms. Medication paired with psychotherapy is the most effective way to promote recovery. Case management. Case management coordinates services for an individual with the help of a case manager. A case manager can help assess, plan, and implement a number of strategies to facilitate recovery. Hospitalization. In a minority of cases, hospitalization may be necessary so that an individual can be closely monitored, accurately diagnosed, or have medications adjusted when his or her mental illness temporarily worsens. Support groups. A support group is a group meeting where members guide each other towards the shared goal of recovery. Support groups are often comprised of non-professionals, but peers that have suffered from similar experiences. I was just pondering the other day how we often separate mental and physical illnesses, and I thought there's an interesting one that often doesn't fall really neatly between both of those, and that is dementia. Of course, I think most people, if you were to say, would you rather have physical health or mental health actually is more primary. Doesn't do much good to have a healthy body if your mind is gone. Wanted to do a story here from CNN about dementia. Eat well, exercise more. New global guidelines to reduce risk of dementia. There's no effective treatment for dementia, which affects 50 million people worldwide. But the World Health Organization says there's much that can be done to delay or slow the onset and progression of the disease. The World Health Organization issued its first recommendations to reduce the risk of dementia globally. They include regular physical exercise, not using tobacco, drinking less alcohol, maintaining healthy blood pressure, and eating a healthy diet, particularly a Mediterranean one. The International Health Body also warned against taking dietary supplements such as vitamins B and E in an effort to combat cognitive decline and dementia. The World Health Organization said that there are 10 million new cases of dementia every year, and this figure is set to triple by 2050. The disease is a major cause of disability and dependency among older people, and can devastate the lives of affected individuals, their caregivers, and families. This story is a good example of the convergence of health recommendations for a variety of health issues. You might put it under the category of, is there anything that diet and exercise doesn't help with? In fact, if you look at the top 16 leading causes of death in the United States, diet actually relates to every single one of them. The brain is obviously part of our body, and if you are doing things good for your body, you're doing things good for your brain. One way to think about it is, if you're doing something good for your heart, you're probably doing something good for your brain. Okay, on to the next issue, which is also related to mental health. This from Science Daily. For people with strong life purpose, making healthier choices may take less effort. Ever wonder how some people seem to meet their fitness goals with ease and love eating healthy foods while others constantly struggle to do either? According to a new study from the Communication Neuroscience Lab at the Annenberg School, people with stronger life purpose are more likely to accept messages promoting health behavior change than those with a weaker sense of purpose, and this might be because they experience less decisional conflict while considering health advice. Purpose in life has been robustly associated with health in previous studies, but the mechanism through which life purpose may promote healthy living has been unclear. Health decisions, even those as simple and mundane as choosing between the elevator and the stairs, involve some amount of decisional conflict, but some people experience less conflict than others when considering these options because they have a stronger guiding purpose that helps resolve the conflicts. So this is kind of on the big picture end of health, in that if you don't have much sense of purpose in life, other things don't really seem to fall in line, and that having a big sense of purpose seems to guide and frame other health issues in a good way. Okay, well, let's move on formally to the public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
A jury handed a $2 billion verdict in favor of a couple in California who say their cancer was caused by long-term exposure to Monsanto's popular weed killer Roundup. The verdict in Oakland includes more than $55 million in compensatory damages to the couple and $2 billion in punitive damages. The verdict is as clear of a statement as you can get that they need to change what they're doing. Thousands of similar cases are pending at the federal or state level. There have also been concerns about whether Monsanto has had undue influence over regulators, with internal company documents playing a key role in the verdict. The jury was shown a mountain of evidence showing Monsanto's manipulation of science, the media, and regulatory agencies to forward their own agenda. That hardly even qualifies as news anymore, but we're going to keep on that story. And in a related vein from Public Health Newswire, it is past time to act on the science to prevent childhood cancer. Cancer is the number one disease-related cause of death in children and the second leading cause of death in children overall after accidents. Rates of childhood leukemia have increased 33% for acute lymphoblastic leukemia and 42% for acute myeloid leukemia in just 35 years, and increases are greater among Hispanic children. Obviously, childhood cancer cannot be blamed on lifestyle-related factors such as exercise levels or smoking. Rather, environmental exposures to pesticides, paints, solvents, and air pollution play key roles along with genetic factors. There is now growing concern about widespread per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, contamination of drinking water. PFAS has been linked to pediatric cancer clusters, and approximately 110 million Americans drink water with dangerous levels of these persistent compounds. The EPA under the current administration is revoking environmental protections at every level. the U.S. is reneging on the Paris Agreement on climate change, replacing the Clean Power Plan with a Potemkin village of coal regulation, undermining basic science, shackling our scientists, and dismantling the protections we once had against environmental chemicals, most notably chlorpyrifos, whose ban EPA scientists had already approved. In August 2018, a federal court ordered the EPA to ban chlorpyrifos within 60 days, but chlorpyrifos continues to be used across the nation despite widespread evidence of acute and chronic harm. Chlorpyrifos and other pesticides like it have been linked to significant losses in IQ, autism, ADHD, autoimmune disease, cancer, and more. And again, in a related story from Nature magazine, U.S. Environmental Agency cuts funding for kids' health studies. The Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health has tracked the lives of hundreds of children in New York City since 1998. Scientists have collected samples of blood, urine, and even the air in children's homes, starting when their subjects were in the womb, to tease out the health effects of chemicals and pollutants. The center's findings influenced New York City's decision in 2018 to phase out diesel buses, and its staff members teach schools and community groups about the harmful chemicals and pollution that kids encounter each day. Now, the future of the Columbia facility and a dozen like it is in doubt. The last grants from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which has provided half of the center's funding for two decades, will expire in July, and the agency has decided that it will not renew its support for the facilities. The program's other government sponsor, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, says that it cannot replace the funding that the EPA has historically provided. Scientists at the Children's Center are increasingly worried that the EPA's withdrawal will force them to shut down decades-long research projects. Studies of this length are rare and valuable because they can reveal associations between environmental exposures early in life and health problems years later. And the mix of threats that kids face changes over time. 20 years ago, what we were studying is not the same as what we're studying today, said Ruth Etzel, a pediatrician at the EPA who specializes in children's environmental health. We have to study children now, in their communities. Many environmental health researchers see the EPA's decision to cut funding for the children's centers as part of a push by President Donald Trump's administration to undermine science at the agency, which is responsible for the safety of U.S. air and water. It works out perfectly for industry, says Tracy Woodruff, who runs the Children's Center at the University of California, San Francisco. When weighing the harms of a chemical against its benefit, she says, if EPA doesn't know, it accounts for zero. The 13 facilities supported by the EPA and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences are scattered in cities across the country and employ hundreds of researchers in disciplines such as toxicology, genetics, and brain development. Their ability to follow people from before birth to adulthood has revealed surprising connections between common chemicals and health. Research by the Columbia Center suggests that the widely used pesticide chlorpyrifos harms the development of children's brains. Chlorpyrifos is used to treat a broad array of food crops, and until 2001, it was legal in the United States for use indoors against insects such as cockroaches. In 2012, Columbia scientists reported that children who were exposed to high levels of the pesticide in the womb had lower IQs and altered brain structure compared to those with low exposure. Last year, Hawaii became the first U.S. state to ban agricultural use of chlorpyrifos and cited the Columbia research. The center's work is also at the heart of an ongoing lawsuit brought by environmental groups seeking to force the EPA to ban all uses of the pesticide. They're just jaw-dropping studies, says Lisa Satterwhite, a molecular geneticist with the Children's Center at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. We could not have anticipated there would be this built-in natural environment. Each of the facilities also works with local groups to educate communities about the findings of their studies, many of which address environmental harms that disproportionately affect people in low-income neighborhoods. The last of the Children's Center's long-term grants from the EPA and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences are set to expire in July. and perhaps some of us more will be expiring due to that. Okay, this from New Jersey, from NJ.com. State ordered chemical companies to pay for pollution cleanup. They say, no way. We won't pay. That's the message that a group of major chemical companies have in response to being ordered by the state of New Jersey to pay for the cleanup of what are known as PFAS chemicals, short for polyfluoroalkyl and perfluoroalkyl substances. The five companies, DuPont, DowDuPont, Chemours, 3M, and Solvay, have all informed the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection that they have no intention to pay for statewide cleanup after a state directive issued in March asserted them to be financially responsible for PFAS contamination around the Garden State. According to the Center for Disease Control, the health effects of PFAS exposure range from increased risk of cancer to stunting the growth of children. Exposure to these chemicals, which have been used to manufacture everything from nonstick cookware and stain-resistant carpets to cosmetics, is even linked to lower chances of pregnancy in affected women. Now back to Ohio, from the Columbus Dispatch. Piketon School closes because of radioactive contamination fears. A school district in southern Ohio has closed its middle school because of concerns of radioactive contamination from a shuttered uranium enrichment plant fewer than 5 miles away. The Scioto Valley Local School District announced it would close Zan's Corner Middle School on Monday after U.S. Department of Energy officials said that they had no plans to stop their work at the former Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, a 3,000-acre facility nearby that stopped producing enriched uranium in 2001. Energy Department contractors are building a waste disposal site on the plant as they work to clean up the site. In an open letter to parents and community members, the school district said it would close the middle school, quote, until the source, extent, level of contamination, and potential impacts to public health and environment can be determined. It is the position of the board that any level of contamination on or near our school is unacceptable, they wrote. The closure of the school came after the Pike County Health Department formally called on the Department of Energy to stop construction of the nuclear waste disposal facility after an independent study also found contamination at other sites in the community. Okay, we're going to switch gears here a little bit. I'll stick with the environmental theme. Going to go back to an even more basic environmental principle, and that is sanitation. This from fastcompany.com. Why is sanitation still a privilege, not a right? This is not an uncommon sight in Lowndes County, Alabama. A stream of sewage waste flowing out of a crude pipe and into the surrounding yard of a resident who just flushed a toilet inside their home. More than 10% of the county's population, which is three-quarters black, lacks access to a comprehensive plumbing system. Some people in the county's larger areas are connected to a centralized sewage disposal system. The rest should be using septic systems, which treat the waste at their homes. But the median household income in Lowndes County is $28,000, and a septic system can cost $30,000. So up to 90% of residents who should be relying on septic systems have one that's broken or don't have one at all. Instead, they lean on straight piping, running waste directly through a pipe out of their homes and into their yards, leading to exposure to human waste that can result in diseases that were thought to be eradicated in the United States. While data on access to sanitation is limited, the research team behind the report estimates that 540,000 households, comprising 1.5 million people, lacks access to good plumbing systems in the U.S. The problem is concentrated in rural and native communities, like Appalachia, the Navajo Nation, and across the South and Midwest. The American Society of Civil Engineers awarded the U.S. a grade of D+ for wastewater infrastructure in both municipal and on-site systems. That near-failing grade reflects the fact that municipal systems are often poorly maintained, leading to sewage backups or flooding, and individual systems are often inadequate or lacking. It also underscores the fact that the policy framework in the U.S. is not designed to support equitable access to sanitation. There are two federal laws, the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, that govern sanitation. But for the most part, enforcement and policy is left up to state, local, and tribal governments. The current policy and funding structure further marginalizes and criminalizes the people who lack access to sanitation and cannot afford it. Because methods like straight piping are technically illegal, households that use it to dispose of waste run the risk of being fined, which adds an additional cost burden but doesn't remedy the core issue of lack of access. A human rights approach to sanitation starts with the principle that for everyone, access to functioning and safe systems is a right, not a privilege. Municipal sewage systems should be regularly upgraded. Local, state, and federal governments should coordinate resources to create funding pools for people who don't have the financial means to buy and maintain septic systems. Instead of criminalizing people who cannot comply with sanitation requirements, governments and nonprofits should support them financially and structurally to come into compliance. Wow. And for those of you who thought poor sanitation is so last millennia, maybe it's not. It was about 100 years ago that advanced sanitation efforts drastically reduced infectious disease rates in the United States, particularly those infectious diseases due to fecal contamination. In fact, this was the number one public health achievement of the 20th century. This report shows that about 0.5% of U.S. lack advanced sewage systems. And of course, this is a tragedy. But I would like to switch a little bit gears and expand the perspective to a global perspective. This from the World Health Organization. 29% of the global population lack safely managed drinking water supplies, and 61% are without safely managed sanitation services. 892 million people continue to practice open defecation. Let me just say that again. 892 million people in the world continue to practice open defecation. Only 27% of the population in less developed countries have basic hand washing facilities. Wow. So, what does this mean worldwide? Well, let's look at what the CDC has to say about diarrhea, common illness, global killer. Overall, about 500,000 children die each year from diarrheal diseases. And of course, this is aggravated by poor nutrition. In this country, our poor nutrition is usually poor quality, but around the world, just simple lack of food can even further aggravate diarrheal diseases from infectious disease. And this is a truly a missed opportunity worldwide in public health. In addition to rotavirus vaccination and breastfeeding, diarrhea prevention focuses on safe water and improved hygiene and sanitation. This is not only possible, but cost effective. For every $1 invested, yields an average return of $25.50. Wow, what other thing can you think of that would bring over $25 return for every dollar? If people would like public health to be run like a business, this would be a good way to do it. But does that happen? No, because public health isn't a business. Politics, unfortunately, may be more of a business too. We see examples from around the world where we're actually seeing moves to privatize water rather than make it more universally acceptable to people. So I would invite people to take advantage in moves in politics and public health to move us towards taking advantage of these wondrous opportunities and truly see that these returns on our investments in health, even more so than just simple dollars, is profound, and that should be the business of everybody. Okay, in a related story from The Guardian, mismanaged waste kills up to 1 million people a year globally. Mismanaged waste is causing hundreds of thousands of people to die each year in the developing world from easily preventable causes. And plastic waste is adding a new and dangerous dimension to the problem, a report has found. Municipal waste frequently goes uncollected in poor countries, and its buildup fuels the spread of disease. Between 400,000 and 1 million people are dying as a result of such mismanaged waste, according to the charity Tear Fund. While mismanaged waste has been a problem for decades, the growth of plastic pollution, which does not break down in the environment, is adding a fresh set of problems to an already dire situation. Plastic waste is blocking waterways and causing flooding, which in turn spreads waterborne diseases. When people burn the waste to get rid of it, it releases harmful toxins and causes air pollution. Among the other harmful impacts of plastic pollution in poor countries are the loss of fishing, as marine animals ingest the plastic, damage to agriculture, as up to a third of cattle and half of goats in developing countries have consumed significant amounts of plastic, harming their health as it leads to potentially fatal bloating, and large amounts of plastic waste washing up on shorelines and coral reefs, deterring tourists on whom many poor countries rely. At least 2 billion people around the world do not have their rubbish collected, and piles of it can build up in waterways, causing pollution or rot in areas near where people live. Living near rubbish doubles the risk of contracting diarrhea, the report found, which is a major cause of death in the developing world. Hundreds of thousands of people around the world make a living from collecting waste, in some cases by collecting cans or bottles that can be recycled or returned, or, more dangerously, as waste pickers who live on rubbish dumps and scavenge what they can. This is hazardous work, not only because of the pollution to which people are exposed, but also because of the risk of physical injury, not least because poorly managed dumps are often affected by landslides and even explosions from the buildup of gases. Ruth Valerio, the Global Advocacy and Influencing Director of Tear Fund, said the organization was calling on four multinationals that produce huge amounts of plastic packaging, Coca-Cola, Nestle, PepsiCo, and Unilever, to take responsibility for their products throughout the supply chain and provide ways for the waste to be managed. Okay, let's take some responsibility. Well, that does it for our show today. If you have any comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to listen or re-listen to the show or any previous shows, please go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some